the Australian Defence Magazine podcast. Serving the business of defence. With Grant McHerron, Ewan Levick, Nigel Pittaway, and Ben Felton.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the show. For this episode, wait a minute, folks. What's that music? This is different. We've got the gang together, but we've got a couple of interlopers have joined us. Michael Shoebridge, Marcus Hellyer, welcome to the gang.
It's great to be with you, Grant.
Yeah, we've hacked into your system, and we are undermining the system from within here.
We got the data from Elon through his Doge work with data mining in the US, and we're just delighted it came off.
And you and your bank balance is looking a little dodgy right now. Mine is looking very healthy.
To say I'm nervous is an understatement, guys. Good to have you, though.
And as you can hear laughing in the background, we've also got Nigel.
Good morning, Grant.
And Ben.
Yeah, morning, Grant. Morning, Marcus. Morning, Michael.
Hello. And I just want to point out to all the listeners that, you know, this is a Doge certified event. It is all by males. We do not have a single minority here, so we've ticked that box. And we are all wearing suits.
Yes, with ties. Yeah. Yes. So we decided to record this at 9 o'clock in the morning rather than 5 o'clock in the afternoon to prevent us going off the track, because everyone would be having their inevitable afternoon drinks. So clearly that cunning plan hasn't worked, but we'll just dive right into it, I think, guys. So first item, topical, C3000 and the bureaucratic fallout.
Well, Grant, what an extravaganza from the defence officials in the Parliament at Estimates just a couple of weeks ago. We had Jim McDowell very patiently explain how normally it takes 7, 8, 9, or even 10 years to evaluate a warship, let alone actually start to buy one, build one, or get one. And of course, we can see defence at work with the Hunter frigate with exactly that philosophy. The warship you needed in the 2010s to fight a war sometime in the 2050s. Then he applied that same just wonderful logic to the general purpose frigate. The sole purpose of that program is to do it really quickly. But no, he patiently explained how it would take longer than his boss, Richard Miles, had told the world. And he was going to do it super fast, but no decision could be made by Miles until 2026. That proves such a convincing, compelling logic from the Defence Department that Jim McDowell is no longer employed there.
But was he already going to go before he made those statements?
Well, that's the story. You know, it's like I've decided to spend more time with my family leaving Strategic Analysis Australia. It's not that Marcus sacked me.
Hi, Michael. Bye. I'll offer a slightly different view. I mean, I do, yeah, Jim, I think, didn't help his cause when he said this would normally take 10 years. But you know, people keep saying, oh, look, it's just an off-the-shelf ship. How difficult can it be? And yes, it's great to see that we are going for a broadly off-the-shelf ship. However, the Hunter was meant to be an in-service, in-the-water design, and we massively have screwed that up. So we are now paying $27 billion for three ships that combined in terms of capability do not even equal the one destroyer, Chinese destroyer, that was one missile shot off Sydney. So that's a great triumph. The OPV program has also been a total disaster, meant to be an off-the-shelf design that we picked, and then we decided it actually doesn't do anything that we need a ship to do. And similarly, we wasted $4 billion on the French attack-class submarine before we cancel that. So I sort of want to be sympathetic to Jim to say, look, I want to get this right before I put my signature on a recommendation to government. And the thing we sort of are a bit forgetting is there's two stages to this. One is the first supposedly three ships that will be built overseas. So I think pretty much everyone thinks it'll end up being more than three. But then there's the second half of this program, which is to set up production in Henderson and build the next supposedly eight ships in Henderson. Well, if you're one of the contenders, you're looking at Henderson and going, this place is a mess. What am I meant to be doing here? Am I meant to own the shipyard? Is the government going to own the shipyard? Do I need to build a shipyard? Do I have to work with Austal? Do I have to work with CivMec? By the way, where is the nuclear submarine sustainment stuff going? You know, and the government has just kicked off 3 years of studies to somehow answer all of those questions. But I'm submitting a bid to, you know, presumably with tender quality costs in it, to say how I'm going to build ships there next decade. So it is a non-trivial task there. But yes, I would agree that Jim didn't cover himself in glory with that. You know, it would normally take 10 years kind of.
Yeah, I feel for Jim though, because I think, you know, that is caught. That is a good example of being caught between Russell and the Hill, and the competing priorities of government versus the processes of defence, and it just so happened that it was in a public forum and Senate estimates. But to your point, Marcus, about, you know, C3000 and what, where these things are actually going to be built, you know, one of the, like, there's so many questions. Where do you even start? But one of them has to be what the supply chain is going to look like for the ships that start to be built in Henderson, 4 through 6 or 4 through 7. If 1 through 3 are using existing supply chains in Japan or Germany, are 3 through 6, are Australian companies involved in that or not? Or are we getting, you know, is the supply chain just going to lift from Germany or Japan and build there? What's the cost implications of that?
Yeah, but call me crazy. But
you're crazy.
With all of that uncertainty about Henderson, to try to get costed proposals from either Germany or Japan about the build in Australia is madness, because there are no fixed boundaries, and the boundaries are moving that are in the federal government and state government's control. So any numbers they give, the companies give, are meaningless because the governments do not have clarity. And then there's another little thing that's happened. I don't know if anyone's noticed, but Germany may be completely obsessed with security in Europe rather than setting up supply chains and production for small surface ships in Australia. So I just think this decision is not very hard. It should be about the first 3 ships and all the bugger's muddle of Henderson that the government has created shouldn't be foisted onto 2 companies who cannot answer the question.
I was going to suggest that, and far be it for me to actually come out swinging for defence, but this has muddied waters greatly as far as defence is concerned, and this is a government decision and not defence. So at what point do we say defence's attitude is to blame for muddying these waters in the first place?
Poor old defence that is building the Hunters. That is its nirvana. It delivers the Hunters. 3 ships, the only more expensive warship on the planet than the Hunter, defence officials told the Parliament, is a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. And the Hunters, with the first 3, are outgunned by a single Chinese warship that just circumnavigated our country. So that's defence left to itself.
I'm not apologising for defence, Michael, but I'm just saying that I think there's a few more fingers in the pie here.
Well, there needs to be more fingers in the pie, because defence needs to be told what to do.
You guys were at the ADM Congress. What did you make of Andrew Hastie's semi-commitment to the findings of the DSR, including the General Purpose Frigate Program?
Yeah, I'm a huge advocate for uncrewed systems, the small, the smart, the many, but ultimately you need some ships. And because of recommendations from the senior leadership of the Defence Department, we are on the cusp of not having a Navy with any ships. I mean, yes, I'm a big fan of following the Ukrainians, but I'm not sure we want to follow the Ukrainian model of having a Navy with no ships. So you kind of got to do something, and we've run out of time. I mean, Michael and I have been saying for years that we are on the cusp of a major, major strategic disaster with our shipbuilding, both in our surface and subsurface fleets. So finally, the government has realized that. Now, is the general purpose frigate the best solution? So people say, well, we actually need bigger frigates, or, you know, so everybody's going to have their own view. But as I pointed out, the sorry history of our shipbuilding enterprise, we have, you know, I added up the numbers the other day. We are now well over $10 billion in money spent since the previous government announced its 2017 shipbuilding plan. What have we delivered for that? We have now gotten handed over to defense, but not commissioned, 1 OPV with exactly the same firepower as the patrol boat it was meant to be replacing. So, you know, I have no sympathy for defence. You know, defence under the, you know, previous secretary was asked to come up with a frigate that was a mature design in the water and in service, and defense went back to government and said, we like the Type 26, which is none of those things.
But even with the general purpose frigates, technically, because, you know, the Mogami that they're wanting to put, that's not in the water yet. There is one in the water, but not the one that they're saying that they want to put forward for us. And the Miko, yeah, that's in the water, but not the one they want to put forward for us. So neither of the ones that they're saying they are interested in from the government side of things are actually in the water anyhow.
Well, the Mogami is a live construct. The Evolve Mogami is a live construction program. The Japanese have made the extraordinary step of saying, we can have one of the ships they're building for themselves. The concern I have is we're stupid enough not to take that, and we're stupid enough to do what we always do, which is say, I love it, I'll change it all. So the defense left to itself will mess this up. This is actually a strategic decision for government. And if we poke the Japanese in the eye again, when they offer us a government-level strategic and technological partnership, we are insane and should not be taken seriously as a nation.
I agree with that. And I think defence actually put its foot in the door there, didn't it? And asked at least the Germans for a proposal that might have Australian equipment in it as an option. So defence was already feathering the nest before it even kicked off.
Mm-hmm. I'll just point out one little interesting thing in estimates last week on this subject. Cheryl Lutz, who is leading these shipbuilding projects, said that the contenders for C-3000 have now engaged with the shipbuilder. Unfortunately, none of the senators then followed up with a question of, well, who's actually the shipbuilder? Because I haven't heard anything on who is actually the shipbuilder. That's one of those areas of speculation. So has the government anointed Austal? So on top of anointing Austal as their strategic partner for the landing craft projects, have they now anointed Austal as the strategic partner for the frigates? So does that mean the Germans and the French now have to work through Austal to build ships? Or how does that work? So it's just another one of those areas where we've got this incredibly messy situation, but the government is not really helping because it's not telling the Australian people which bits are known and which bits are defined.
I think it's an open question. I don't think either of the bidders yet know, and I'm happy to be corrected, but I don't think anyone knows who is actually going to be building these.
A Bantu in defence said the designers have now engaged with the shipbuilder.
And ironically, in the same estimates hearing, Jim McDowell also said that it was an open question of whether it would be Austal as the prime contractor or whether Austal wouldn't be the prime contractor. So it's kind of all over the place.
We've got an election coming up. How much more muddy do we want in the waters? But perhaps, speaking of muddy and waters and so on, now is probably a time to slide away from C-3000. And how about looking in a real big mud hole of the situation that Ukraine is now in, given the fallout from Trump, what the EU has finally woken up that, oh, yes, there was a train coming. We've known about it since November. We know that this train is barreling towards us. Oh, and we're shocked that we didn't move the car off the tracks and it's been hit. Everyone's acting surprised. We knew it was coming. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
If only listeners could see us all rubbing our heads in frustration.
Well, it is yet another one of those things where Trump has been saying consistently what he's going to do, and then when he does it, everyone's surprised he's actually done it.
Exactly. And what's that imply for ANZUS, AUKUS, and basing of US military here? I mean, we know Trump thinks allies are freeloaders, and he's saying, come on, 3%, 5%. And the one thing about this percentage of GDP that always irks me is, yeah, I can make things 3%. I'll just drop our GDP when we go into a recession. So,
well, just on that point, if you go back to the 2016 white paper funding model, which has essentially been the funding defence has gotten and is still getting right now, all the only addition to that has been an extra $400 million this year, which is a 0.7% increase, essentially over the last decade. But we should have been at about 2.3 or 2.4% already this year. And that But instead, we're still stuck at 2.01-ish, you know, almost exactly 2%. Why is that? Well, because actually GDP has grown much faster than predictions. However, that GDP growth has been driven by inflation, not by actual real productivity growth. It's actually been driven by inflation. So defense's share is smaller than predicted. And by the way, because of inflation, those dollars that defense have been massively devalued. So defense has essentially had probably, you know, 7, 8, 9% cut in its buying power in real terms because of that inflation.
And I think a point that you made, Marcus, or sorry, it may have been Michael, at the ADM Congress, was that even if you do give defense all of that money, it can't spend it anyway.
Well, I think they could. I regret now from the ADM conference not asking for a show of hands and saying, all right, Australian industry out in the audience, if the government threw money at you to deliver capability, could you spend it? And I guess what? I reckon pretty much everybody there would.
Yeah, and look, what I said at the Congress, I still absolutely believe, which is that I wouldn't give the defense organization more money until I knew they could spend it for better purposes and get value. They are flushing money down the toilet, and our military is getting weaker over this decade instead of stronger. So I agree with Marcus. There are medium and small Australian companies that are starved of business and cash flow and are searching for a market everywhere but Australia. And they're providing systems into Ukraine. They're selling them to the UK. They're selling them into the US. And the place that isn't getting Australian capability is Australia. So the problem is the defense organization is not capable of achieving value for money.
Another point you made at Congress that I thought was quite good was, you know, with the Trump administration's focus on allied defense spending, Australia's so far frozen and just not moving to avoid the, you know, the great eye of Sauron sort of hitting us. But we've seen this week, it was Elbridge Colby saying Australia's defense spending is too low compared to our, the American view of our strategic situation. And it needs to be more like 3%. So it seems like finally now the gaze of Washington is now drifting towards us, and we're at 2.whatever percent. And Miles is saying, well, you know, we're having conversations about further conversations to get to 3%.
Well, what a great segue there, Ewan. And that allows me to give a little push for this great publication, No Higher Priority, a Blueprint for the Remediate Action on Australia's Defence 2025 to 2028, published by three great scholars from Strategic Analysis Australia. Michael is one of them. Peter Jennings is another. I'm not sure who the third one is. Published by the Institute for Public Affairs, available on their website. It's essentially, we wrote six papers over the last 6 months in the IPA, for the IPA, and the IPA has now bundled them up into one. Very handsome volume available on the IPA website. And I'm happy to say that we were well ahead of the Elbridge Colby curve there. So one of the things we recommended there is a rapid growth in the defense budget to 3% of GDP, actually aiming to get there, not by the end of the decade, not by the, you know, 2030 something, but in the next approximately 4 years. And we think that's quite doable. We're not saying it because the Americans want us to do it. We're saying it because we need to do it. And in fact, we should have been doing it for a long time already.
Well, in fact, when Richard Miles was asked about Colby's testimony, he said, oh, the good news is I've already talked about this with Pete Hegseth in the Pentagon. And I told him we were very open to an ongoing conversation. And isn't that the Albanese government all over? If they can just keep talking, talk out the clock, you know, let's have an ongoing conversation. I don't think the Trump administration wants an ongoing conversation about our defense capability. I think they want to see us pulling more of our own weight. And it's embarrassing to have to be blackmailed by America to do what we should for our own security. It reminds me of that, you know, the referee's comment about someone. They do their best work when cornered like a rat.
And we have to do it. So to get back to your question earlier, Ewan, about, you know, C-3000, Well, whether they're the right ships exactly or not, our Navy is in terrible shape, you know. And listening to the Chief of Navy at Estimates last week, where he was asked about the Navy's performance in, you know, shadowing the Chinese Naval Task Force that not only showed up off Sydney, you know, one missile shot off our major populations, but then circumnavigated at Australia, doing a Matthew Flinders, while showing us the finger all the way around. And we couldn't actually keep up with them because guess what? We don't have a tanker in service. We have two tankers, both of which have been broken for a long time. No word on when they're going to be back in service. So we don't have a tanker. So we couldn't actually keep up with them as they did their ceremonial circumnavigation.
Yeah, I saw that point, Marcus. You know, if they went out into the Indian Ocean and we have to refuel at port, I mean, they could have just basically run us dry.
Meanwhile, the Chief of Navy at Estimates has the gall to say, everything's going swimmingly well. I'm very happy with the performance and availability of ships is great. Well, I actually went back and looked at the data on availability, and it has been progressively declining. So major ship unit availability days has been progressively declining since 2016-17. We've gone from about, you know, 3,400 days a year. We're down to 2,400 days a year. So we have lost 1,000 days of ship availability. And yet, according to the Chief of Navy, all is going swimmingly well.
If you imagine these Chinese ships coming out towards Australia's region more often needing to be shadowed, it dramatically changes the demand on Navy and those surface combatants, which traditionally, to an extent, have been able to work up, go to a regional presence deployment and come back. Whereas if you look at what's been tracking these ships, it's been four of the seven Anzac-class frigates that have been working very, very hard to keep up with them, as we said. But okay, the Chinese Navy goes home, those ships go into maintenance, and that's four ships which are now being maintained and can't be used for a deployment. So it just really starts to erode everything. And that's not even to mention the fact that the frigates are now having to do border protection work again because of the surge in illegal fishing. There's like a lot of pressure on the service fleet. And I think I completely agree with your point, Marcus, that even if they're not the perfect ships, they just need to be the ships.
Is that an argument for more Tritons, maybe?
Well, I was going to bring up Triton because, you know, again, I'm no operational expert, but I understand we had a P-8 monitoring these Chinese ships. Isn't that what the Tritons are for? Aren't we supposed to have this long loitering, this capability that can loiter over the Southern Ocean 24/7? And we've got three Tritons now, right? So that's...
No, we've only got one Triton now.
Oh,
we've only
got one. Country.
Okay. Undergoing acceptance by the US Navy. And that Triton hasn't flown. It's still going through its Air Force acceptance.
Let's just be very simple about this. Shadowing warships that comprehensively outclass and outgun you with clapped out old Anzacs, which if all seven circled that task force, would have half the missile load that the single cruiser had, leaving out the frigate. This is a losing thing to do. So talking about could we possibly have the Anzac shadow them more effectively and will they wear out faster, that is an irrelevant piece of nonsense, frankly. And the idea that we should buy more Tritons, those things are the dumbest kind of unmanned system you can have. They have all the complexity and expense of a manned system, and yet they're unmanned. They've taken over two decades to develop, and we still don't have them in service. They're going out of production in the US because the US think they're too expensive for what they do. We have a home advantage. Why do we not have cheap, medium-range UAVs flying from small airfields or trucks or pickups from Australia shadowing that fleet? Why do we always think we should go for the complex, the few, and the expensive? It's an absurdity.
There's also the question of air defense. Like, say they were sitting in the Tasman and they decided they didn't like, you know, this podcast, and they wanted to shoot a missile at Michael's house. What air defense have we got that would have handled that off Sydney?
The short answer is virtually none. Right. The short answer is virtually none. So, a quick inventory about air defense. So, land based, we now have. The NASAMS system produced by Kongsberg, which is very effective, and the Ukrainians have been using it very effectively. But it is not really designed to defend huge things like Australia, and it's not really designed for ballistic missile defense. So if we knew exactly what they wanted to shoot, you could probably protect one or two places with NASAMS if we knew that they were going to attack with cruise missiles. In the maritime space, we have three air warfare destroyers. They're about to go in for a big upgrade. So on any given day, we're going to have two, which means you can't guarantee one at sea. So let's assume we knew exactly what the bad guys wanted to attack. You might be able to position it there to defend it if you knew well in advance where they were going to be. And then we have our JSFs, which, and interestingly, we've seen in conflicts recently that fighter planes are actually pretty effective in shooting down cruise missiles. So the Ukrainians have been doing it, the Americans and Israelis have been doing it. But again, you sort of have to know where they're going to be and be in the right place. And all of that points to the fact that if you're a continental power trying to sort of statically defend, you know, your homeland against a maritime power, which can move its ships wherever it wants to go, you're screwed. That's why maritime powers beat continental powers, because they have mobility and flexibility. And as, in my view, Australia's always, in a sense, kind of seen itself as a continental power, not a true maritime power. And so the Chinese have illustrated the advantages of, you know, maritime power over kind of static continental land-based power in this regard. So that's a long way of saying we don't have much. You know, and if our strategy is to somehow sit here, wait for the bad guys to show up, and then we shoot them once they get within, you know, one missile range, it's all over. So,
well, there's a couple of things that are interesting, I think. One is we took homeland defense more seriously in the Age of Sail. So that's what Fort Denison was about in Sydney Harbour. We haven't even bothered hardening any of our bases with the billions of dollars we spent refurbishing them. So, and the Japanese that bombed Darwin bombed an unprotected facility with aircraft parked out in the open. Well, guess what? That could happen again, because we still have unprotected aircraft. And it's the same with the submarines and the Navy ships. So we could harden and protect the bases at least. But we need some homeland defense capability to move around to protect critical infrastructure and at least be able to say to the Australian people, we can do something. Because Ukraine and the Middle East show, if the military is fat, dumb, and happy protected and the population isn't, guess what? It's an unhappy time. So we need to do more. But also with warships floating off the coast, what if they knew we had a large number of small unmanned undersurface vessels that were armed and unarmed? That would change their calculation. And we could use our home advantage. They don't have to be long range. But we are not using our home advantage in any way.
On the topic of Ukraine, we've been dancing around it a little bit. What do we make of the US administration's complete capitulation to Vladimir Putin's demands?
What can you say other than it is an absolute disgrace? But I'll give another little historical analogy here, because I know Michael loves listening to my long historical stories. So in the 18th century, at the start of the Seven Years' War between Britain and France, the British executed one of their own admirals, Admiral Byng, because he had fought an inconclusive naval battle with the French. And he was condemned, not for cowardice, not for treason, but because he hadn't done his utmost, and they executed him for that. It was quite controversial, but Voltaire, the French philosopher, you know, looked at this and he said, look at the British, they've executed one of their admirals to encourage the others. You know, and after that, the performance of the British admirals actually increased, because they were all aware that if you don't do your utmost, you could get executed. You know, so you can look at it. You know, the Ukraine, you go, well, it may be in Trump's four-dimensional chess, that's what he's trying to do. You know, I'll shoot one partner and that will encourage the others to do better. But, you know, I don't think any of us really think that the Trump is playing four-dimensional chess. But look, I think there is a takeaway here, and that is you've got to do more, because you cannot absolutely rely on the US. And that has been the underpinning of our defense strategy for 80 years now. And in the space of a few days, that has fallen apart. Now, we still have that professional crew of AUKUS grifters you know, both here and in the US, saying, you know, don't worry, it'll all be good. Nothing to fear here. The US is still absolutely reliable. I'm not going to trust a crowd of paid AUKUS grifters to essentially do my strategic thinking for me.
And that's a question that I had for the Grumpies, actually, was with all of this movement in the last week or so, where does that put AUKUS, and how much should we rely or be relying on AUKUS, given that things can change so very quickly?
Well, AUKUS is a three-nation, multi-hundreds of billion-dollar, multi-decade partnership around crown jewel technology, nuclear submarines. To do a multi-decade, multi-hundred billion-dollar three-nation partnership, you need stability and trust between all three of the partners. We clearly do not have that with America now. And this thing about Ukraine, it's unthinkable that an American president would withdraw support to a partner in a war in the middle of the war. But that is what the Trump administration has already done. And to know, was it vindictive for them to turn off intelligence sharing, not just materiel, intelligence sharing, which is electrons. That shows this is a decision taken with intent to disable the Ukrainian war effort. And this is why European defense stocks have risen so spectacularly. The Europeans are understanding they no longer have a reliable ally. And anyone that thinks it's good Trump in Asia and bad Trump in Europe, there is only Trump.
Yeah, they are smoking crack. And, you know, you hear this from political conservatives saying, well, we like what Trump is doing domestically, but we don't like what he's doing internationally. There is one Trump. And the, you know, conventional political wisdom that has stood the test of time is that is the primacy of domestic politics. You know, politicians are driven by domestic politics. And that is even more so in the case of Trump. He knows that nobody outside of America has a vote. It is only Americans who have a vote. So if we somehow think, well, we don't really like what's going on domestically, but it'll all be fine in the international sphere, you are smoking it, you know. And, you know, one of the things I have sort of started to think about and write about is that, you know, MAGA is not the same as US primacy. So this idea of US primacy that has been part of the DC Beltway blob's DNA since World War II, that it is worth it for the US to spend 3.5% of GDP on defense to ensure its primacy, to ensure global peace and stability, because there is a benefit to Americans and individual Americans. That is not MAGA thinking at all. And, you know, listening to Elbridge Colby do at his confirmation hearing the other day, he is one of those traditional, you know, Beltway blob people trying to hit the incongruence between what he's saying and trying to reconcile that with Trump's MAGAism is just completely unconvincing. Completely unconvincing.
I think at that same hearing, he said Taiwan should be spending 10% of their GDP on defense, and then turned around and said, you know, Taiwan isn't a vital defense interest for the United States. So it's that same contradiction. And I mean, we don't say it publicly, but we're all worried, and defense is worried about a Taiwan contingency, if you want to use that word. And then the US says, oh, it might not be a vital interest.
Well, there that is consistent, because when you say Taiwan's not vital to US interests, the corollary of that is, well, you're on your own, so you'd better be spending at least 10%, you know, which is, or 5% for the Europeans. And so if Albo and Richard Miles think we're going to skate through on 2%, you know, they're deluded. I mean, because either way, you've got to be spending more, because if you think the US is going to help you, they're only going to do it if you're spending more. If the US is not going to help us, then we would certainly need to be spending more.
I get frustrated by two common sort of tropes here. You know, one of them is this idea that Australia and the US are best friends forever and the US will never abandon us. Trump doesn't have friends. And you can go to any number of other countries and they'll say the same thing. If you go to the UK, they'll say, oh, no, we're America's best friend forever. If you go to Canada, they say, we're America's best friend forever. And the idea that Trump would treat us any differently to how he's treating Canada or Ukraine is, in my mind, completely deluded. But the other thing that gets me is I've been hearing for 10 years that Europe needs to be more self-sufficient. And the Europeans have been saying for almost a decade now since Trump first came to power that, you know, the American alliance is no longer reliable. But Europe has not, in my view, lifted its weight on Ukraine. And I'm not convinced that the announcements we've seen in the last 2 weeks are going to change that. I think Europe is hamstrung by its own indecision.
Ukraine is lifting its own weight. It's now producing 30% of its own needs, and it is now the world leader in drone, counter-drone, and electronic warfare technology. And they've developed their own indigenous missile production capability out of nowhere. And when you talk about Europeans not doing anything for 10 years, Australians have been telling ourselves since 2009, our region is getting dangerous and ugly because of the rise of China. We have been deluded for at least as long as the Europeans, and we have done far less. At least the Europeans have the most capable military power in Europe, being the Ukrainians, as long as they don't have the rug pulled out from under them.
Or Poland, I'd point to Poland too.
Well, I think battle-hardened Ukrainians would outclass the Poles, but the Poles are extremely impressive. So that's the key point. Look at our part of the world. We've got Japan, fantastic partner, but are we taking full advantage of that and working with them as we should? Back to the frigate. South Korea, an abiding obsession with North Korea, but capable. But we don't have the lifting power that Europe already has. So let's look in the mirror before we criticize the Europeans. And back to that point, alliances are based on trust and confidence. The Trump administration is trashing that.
Can I just take the conversation back to AUKUS for a moment and the events of this last week in particular? Is it time then for Australia to start thinking maybe beyond AUKUS or outside AUKUS? Should we be doing that now?
Well, look, I'll answer that with a sort of meta comment, and that AUKUS is not an alliance. AUKUS is simply one facet of our alliance with the US and one facet of our relationship with the UK. Let me just point out, we do not have an alliance with the UK. Yeah. We have a military alliance with two countries, the US and New Zealand. So if the US is wobbly, guess what? It's New Zealand. So we are in an infinitely worse position than the Europeans, because even without the US, five of the largest GDPs in the world are still part of NATO. So we are in a very, very vulnerable position. Now, AUKUS is not an alliance. It's always been a technological partnership to get us some technology. Well, you know, what I would argue is a single technology is never the difference between, you know, victory and defeat. You know, so SSNs may be a good capability. You can argue for or against it and whether it's value for money. But anybody who thinks that somehow having SSNs was going to be the difference between victory and defeat was deluded. So, and to me, that's one of the problems with AUKUS is this, ever since AUKUS was announced, people have focused on AUKUS, just looked at AUKUS, and it is an absolute opportunity cost sinkhole. And that's not just the $368 billion. It is the attention span. It is the distraction from all of the other things we need to be doing in terms of resilience, defense capability, partnerships. And it's a massive sinkhole of opportunity cost in terms of human resources, because supposedly 20,000 jobs are going to be put into AUKUS on one capability. So I think Michael, in my view, has always been, we're sort of not necessarily AUKUS skeptics, but AUKUS agnostics. And that is, okay, you want it to happen, fine. First of all, you have to address all the risks, which I don't think we're doing. But secondly, you've got to have other strings to your bow. You've got to have plan B, C, and D. And those are not things that sit on the shelf in the break glass in case of emergency case, but things we need to be doing simultaneously. And in this wonderful publication, No Higher Priority, we talk about some of those things. And we're fans of the B-21. You could argue, well, do you want to double down on yet another exquisite American capability in this day and age? Good, interesting point. But certainly we need to be building our own defence industry, based on the great small and medium Australian companies that are already doing amazing things, unfortunately not being acquired by the Australian Defence Force. So, yeah, look, AUKUS is worth talking about, but I just find it really hard to sort of the conversation is always around AUKUS. That is only one part of our alliance with the US and one part of our national defence capability.
That's great stuff. I would just add, what is AUKUS actually designed to do? What it's designed to do is rebalance military power in the Indo-Pacific away from China towards the US and its allies in a joint deterrence effort of China. But if America doesn't think deterring China from doing something like invading and conquering Taiwan is now the mission, what on earth are we doing with AUKUS?
We're definitely hearing the echoes of 1930s, because remember, before World War II, the UK will never leave Australia, never let Australia down, until they did, and had their fleet destroyed outside Singapore. The bureaucracy is hampering us. We have a military structure that is not working out, and we've had multiple different governments that have not funded defence. I mean, it's not, the current one is just talk, talk, talk. The previous ones were promise, 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 and unfunded. They were the ones who got rid of an armed, medium, long endurance drone. They killed that. And yeah, it's a very, very, very interesting time to be looking at defense, living in the world, and wondering what the heck's going to come up. So realistically, what we're coming to is Australia needs to drink the cup of concrete, invest in its local groups, and throw away this crawl, walk, run crap and go straight to running. That's pretty much it, isn't it?
Yeah. And yes, I agree, Grant. As I said at that wonderful event a few weeks ago, the ADM Annual Congress, Australian industry can run. Let's get rid of this ridiculous crawl, walk, run strategy that defense seems to be incredibly proud of, and to show that somehow they're serious and measured, and going, we're going to crawl towards a future that is running away from us. Australian industry can run, and if you empower them, they will run. And if you look around the world, other countries are running towards the future and empowering their local defense industry, including people like the Houthis, so you don't need to be a modern industrialized state to actually do some of this stuff. So, and I think AUKUS is part of our self-hobbling. We can't do anything until we coordinate with our friends in the US and UK. Well, how about we put some of that aside and we trust Australian industry?
Marcus, the difference is the Houthis are not a sedentary population, okay? So, it's easier for them to run. But don't you think a big explanation for the defence bureaucracy with their crawl, walk, run is crawling happens for 3 or 5 years in this graceful phasing. Walking happens beyond that, and running is off in the distant future. And the lovely thing, if you're someone like Leon Phillips at the head of the guided weapons enterprise, can't be an enterprise if it's in the Defense Department, for him to embrace crawling is he doesn't actually have to do anything for his entire tenure in the job because he only has to crawl. So it's a wonderful way of using a process to stop you having to deliver any results.
You don't want to be crawling after 2 or 3 years or however long it's been.
You'd have real concerns about the development of your child if they were crawling after 3 to 5 years. But I agree with Michael. So, one of the most distressing things that to come out of the Defence Strategic Review was this concept of epochs. So we've got these three epochs. One is the epoch now where we're going to do is whatever we can with the systems we have now, and then we'll have a second epoch where we'll do some more, and then... Well, guess what? Epochs are geological terms. So if ever you wanted to come up with a metaphor that killed any prospect of rapid progress, it would be to use geological
terminology.
But it sounds so grand, doesn't it? It's like when Miles gives those steely-eyed speeches of resolve, and then you realize nothing's happening.
Do you know what? By the time we actually get nuclear-powered submarines, because I think we all can agree that the chances of us getting Virginia-class off the US are becoming smaller and smaller each week, Australia might have actually, the continent might have drifted so close to Asia that we won't need the range of nuclear-powered submarines.
It'll be a land bridge.
It'll be a land bridge straight to Taiwan.
You know, one thing I was pleased about was I think the government is starting to get sufficiently embarrassed with the Americans. And the reason I think that is Miles, when he had his first contact with the Trump administration, realized he was in trouble. So he packed a suitcase full of unmarked bills, $800 million, to hand over to the Americans. And I think that was the embarrassment dawning on him. The only way I'm going to look like I'm getting out of trouble is to hand a giant suitcase full of unmarked bills to my American friend.
But the very next day, they put tariffs on the steel that we're producing for American Virginia-class submarines.
Don't you just have a sense that in international relations, we are in the middle of just a bad mob movie? You know, So we've got the poor schmuck, you know, the little fish and chip shop owner or, you know, corner shop owner showing up at the Mafia Don's, you know, home with this paper bag with a whole bunch of cash saying, there you go, boss. You know, here's our protection money for this month, you know.
That came from.
And then you look at, you know, poor old Zelensky in the Oval Office, and you've got the mafia boss there giving him crap. And then you've got the mafia boss's henchman saying, hey, boss, you want me to hold him down? You can kick him in the balls again. Yeah, kick him in the balls, boss. Making sure respect. You need some respect. I want to see more respect, you schmuck. Kick him in the balls.
Good summary.
That is where we've gotten to in, you know, international relations.
And you know what? They're gonna wake up. You know, what's to stop Trump and J.D. Vance waking up tomorrow and saying, you know what, next time you come over, bring $800 million and $500 billion worth of rare earth. Or wake up one day and go, you know what, they have no negotiating power, double the price of the submarines.
Yeah, or gosh, I want my Gaza thing to happen. So gosh, Australia, you got to take 250,000 Palestinian refugees.
Yeah, or we want sovereignty over Christmas Island or Cocos Keeling Islands or, you know, one of it. Or, you know,
actually, we want to have sovereignty over where our bases are. So Pine Gap, Northern Territory, everywhere else. You know, we'll just take it.
The most amazing thing about this conversation, it's not happening in Canberra. The defence organisation is still fat, dumb and happy and congratulating itself.
Marcus is in Canberra, I think, aren't you, Marcus?
I'm in Canberra.
They're congratulating themselves and they're just keeping on like none of this is happening. You know, it's the unthinkable problem. It's unthinkable that America would stop support to a partner engaged in a war of existence for it. It's unthinkable that an American president would posit using armed force to take control of Canada and Greenland and the Panama Canal. So the unthinkable things have already happened. So it's not unthinkable that our alliance is unreliable. So we need to do something ourselves.
It brings us to the much bigger point that, you know, in the trajectory of American democracy is downhill. And whether it's Trump or whether it's in 20 years or in 30 years, you know, the rise of an American empire and the consequences of that for Australia or an American autocrat are, I mean, talking about unthinkable, but that seems to be the trajectory that America's on. What does that mean for us?
Well, I'm not going to prognosticate America and say it's a busted flush forever, because it's an extremely destructive and creative kind of democracy. It has destroyed and recreated itself several times, including economically and technologically. So I think there are a bunch of antibodies to this path America's on. But Marcus's point, you know, this is a large number of Americans who think they don't want to keep doing what they've been doing since the Second World War. And that is the foundational problem that Australia and other American allies have.
And I think we tend to, well, let me make some big philosophical points. First one is we're terrible at predicting the future.
You know, we are absolutely terrible at predicting the future. So smart people, whether they're in government or business, hedge their options. You know, we have done nothing to hedge our options strategically or in terms of military capability. And AUKUS, in a sense, is simply a matter of doubling down on plan A, not a plan B. And so we've got to be much better at hedging. And we have to look at the world with our blinkers removed. So the number of times you hear from people in defense, you know, CDF, secretaries, ministers saying, we will never fight alone. Well, actually, sorry, you're confusing what you want the future to be with what the future may actually be. Because, you know, we could be a Ukraine. So we need to actually think about that unthinkable of what does fighting alone mean. Now, you can have a number of responses to that. One is to spend a lot more on GDP. One is to be a lot nicer to China and turn a blind eye to China's misdeeds. And, you know, there's other options in between. But at the moment, we are in the, we'll never fight alone because the US will always stand by us, and there's no hedging going on there at all.
We are definitely in a 1930s moment where and you mentioned, Marcus, about the British executing an admiral. Well, they also did, not quite as drastic, but a lot of senior leaders suddenly went sideways or out when they discovered that these people were more aligned with the status quo, bureaucracy, the keeping things going slowly rather than reacting and doing what was required in a time of war.
Yeah, well, in long periods of peace, you do not want an activist, innovative, fast-moving defense organization. So you build processes that keep it on life support, half asleep in the cryogenic freezer, and you choose leaders that show no initiative and just keep the lights on. But when it's break glass time, history shows those leaders in those organizations are the wrong leaders. And so what happens then is they get replaced. But we're just sticking with them and they're just keeping the lights on and acting like, I don't know, sleepy security guards in the event something happens. They've forgotten what their purpose is.
All the warnings are there. You know, the Chinese, as you said, sailing around.
They think their purpose is to kind of uphold the US alliance. You know, so everything we have done, whether it is in terms of force structure or capability or engagement, has been to kind of manage the US alliance and carefully calibrate our contributions so we get maximum goodwill in return for minimum real-life contributions. And, you know, they haven't registered that the world has moved on very dramatically.
But look what's happening now. AUKUS now is the thing that has to be protected and preserved at all costs by Australia. So we will turn ourselves inside out and contort ourselves and deny what's happening in the world and in America because we see that AUKUS is essential to preserve. When it's back to that point, AUKUS only makes sense if America is determined to play the role it has been playing.
Isn't AUKUS just a defense take on the TPP in a way? Like, it's this idea of trying to bind the US to Australia and the region. Like, we hear people talk about, like, this will make the US care. But I think you're right. Like, it's if the US doesn't want to care, and a large percentage of US voter base doesn't.
Why should the US care between now and 2054? By 2054, we have 8 nuclear submarines. If everything goes perfectly, including UK design and production of nuclear submarines. And by 2054, there are 8 additional nuclear... No, not even 8, because the Americans haven't backfilled. We have 8 nuclear submarines, 2 of which can reliably go to sea. That doesn't seem to bind a global power in any way.
And it doesn't deter a major power adversary either. So, look... It's possible that AUKUS still makes sense, but I do think we need to be having a conversation. And by AUKUS, I mean the acquisition of 8 nuclear-powered submarines. It may make sense. We're not even having that conversation. I mean, it's quite striking that the first thing Richard Miles did was to go to America, drop the paper bag or the suitcase. I haven't seen photos to see what the money was actually contained in, but maybe it was a check. Pete Hegseth said the check had cleared, so maybe...
It's funny, you go to America, people still use checks. It's weird. I mean, it's like going back to the 1950s. But you know, that was the first thing we did, was to go, gosh, make sure that AUKUS is okay. Again, as if that one single capability of some nuclear submarines is the most fundamental, you know, aspect of our national defense.
And what tangible goods did we get for the sack of money?
None. It's a non-refundable, no strings attached gift.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it buys the protection you would get if you were dealing with a mafia don.
There you go.
Well, the other thing is, I'll just on the mafia thing, mafia dons smell fear, you know, and when the first thing you do is show up there with a bag of cash, you are reeking with fear, you know, and so if they think we really want those submarines, they will exploit that to the hilt.
Gents, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a really good conversation. I think we'll wrap it around there.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Good to talk with you.
Been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. It's been like sitting inside a grumpy strategist's head.
It's a happy place.
God help us.
And on that note, I'd like to say thanks to everyone who's joined this call. And guys, it's been fascinating. We've gone around a lot of different topics and it's really kind of scary. But Marcus, I'll give you one last go at the plug cast, because I would ask, okay, Grumpies, you're now in charge of Australia. What should we do? But I think that's in the book, isn't it?
It is in the books. No higher priority. You can find it on the IPA website. You do have to pay for it, but the digital version is very reasonable, I believe $12. But also, if you are still, you know, suffering from the cost of living crisis, the IPA website has the individual papers that are still downloadable for free.
Well, remember, everybody, freedom ain't free.
It costs a buck 09, as I think the movie said. And on that note, I'd like to thank everyone for listening once again. And don't forget, if you enjoyed this episode, you can like us on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice, as this helps others discover our show. Meanwhile, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back in the not-too-distant future with another informative episode, but I can't guarantee it will be as amazing as this one.
The ADM Podcast is produced by Southern Skies Media on behalf of Australian Defence Magazine, a YEFA media title. The views of the people appearing on this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Australian Defence Magazine, the Department of Defence, or the guest's employer. If you wish to use any of the audio in this podcast, please contact Australian Defence Magazine via their website, australiandefence.com.au, or via email at defmag@yaffa.com.au.
You've been listening to a Yaffa Media podcast.
Southern Skies Media.